Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, and I post links to it at pieville.net, our microblog. Also at kirksvilletoday.com, our daily wrap-up of world events as they pertain to the interests and fortune of the white race, which is our concern. Today, we are going to conclude the Clovis section of Hector Human Row, The Complete Stories of Saki, with two slightly longer stories, but it will amount to the usual length with four shorter stories. These stories are Ministers of Grace and The Remolding of Groby Lington, a typical Saki name, kind of odd. So let us begin with Ministers of Grace. Ministers of Grace, and that's in apostrophes, so it's someone else's term. Although he was scarcely yet out of his teens, the Duke of Scaw, S-C-A-W, was already marked out as a personality widely differing from others of his caste and period. Not in externals. Therein he conformed correctly to type. His hair was fairly reminiscent of Hubignant, or Hubigant, I have no idea who that is, and at the other end of him, his shoes exhaled the right soupçon, that is, small amount, of harness room. His socks compelled one's attention without losing one's respect, and his attitude in repose had just that suggestion of Whistler's mother, so becoming in the really young. It was within that. It was within that the trouble lay, if trouble it could be accounted, which marked him apart from his fellows. The Duke was religious. So you see, even back then, Christianity was dying among the top people. Not in any of the ordinary senses of the word. He took small heed of the high church or evangelical standpoints. He stood outside all of the movements and missions and cults and crusades of the day, uncaring and uninterested, yet in a mystical, practical way of his own, which had served him unscathed and unshaken through the fickle years of boyhood, he was intensely and intensively religious. His family were naturally, though unobtrusively, distressed about it. So if religion is anything more than a sort of tepid love, which amounts to supporting or at least not actively opposing whatever liberalism is pushing, it becomes a thing of social danger, as the English will perceive it, and the same attitude is American. His family were naturally, though unobtrusively, distressed about it. "I am so afraid it may affect his bridge," said his mother, meaning the card game. The Duke sat in a pennyworth of chair in St. James Park, listening to the pessimisms of Belter Bay, who reviewed the existing political situation from the gloomiest of standpoints. "Where I think you political spade workers are so silly," said the Duke, "is in the misdirection of your efforts. You spend thousands of pounds of money, and heaven knows how much dynamic force of brain power and personal energy, in trying to elect or displace this or that man, whereas you could gain your end so much more simply by making use of the men as you find them. If they don't suit your purpose as they are, transform them into something more satisfactory." "Do you refer to hypnotic suggestion?" asked Belter Bay with the air of one who is being trifled with. "Nothing of this sort. Do you understand what I mean by the verb to kopnik or kepnik? That is to say, to replace an authority by a spurious imitation that would carry just as much weight for the moment as the displaced original. The advantage, of course, being that the kepnik replica would do what you wanted, whereas the original does what seems best in its own eyes. I suppose every public man has a double, if not two or three," said Belter Bay, "but it would be pretty hard task to kopnik a whole bunch of them and keep the originals out of the way." There have been instances in European history of highly successful Koepnickery. K-O-E-P, so it's Koper, Koepnickery, said the Duke dreamily. Oh, of course there have been false Dmitries and Perkin Warbecks who imposed on the world for a time, assented Belterbay, but they personated people who were dead or safely out of the way. That was a comparatively simple matter. It would be far easier to pass oneself off as a dead Hannibal than as living Haldane, for instance. The scientist, I believe he was. I was thinking, said the Duke, of the most famous case of all, the angel who Koepnicked King Robert of Sicily with such brilliant results. Just imagine what an advantage it would be to have angels deputizing, to use a horrible but convenient word, for Quinston and Lord Hugo Sizzle, for example. How much smoother the parliamentary machine would work than at present. Now you're just talking nonsense, said Belterbay. Angels don't exist nowadays, at least not in that way, so what is the use of dragging them into a serious discussion? It's merely silly. If you talk to me like that, I shall just do it, said the Duke. Do what? Asked Belterbay. There were times when his young friend's uncanny remarks rather frightened him. I shall summon angelic forces to take over some of the more troublesome personalities of our public life, and I shall send the ousted originals into temporary retirement in suitable animal organisms. It's not everyone who would have the knowledge or the power necessary to bring such a thing off. Oh, stop that inane rubbish, said Belterbay angrily. It's getting wearisome. Here's Quinston coming, he added, as they approached along the almost deserted path the well-known figure of a young cabinet minister whose personality evoked a curious mixture of public interest and unpopularity. Hurry along, my dear man, said the young Duke to the minister, who had given him a condescending nod. Your time is running short, he continued in a provocative strain. The whole inept crowd of you will shortly be swept away into the world's waste paper basket. You poor little strawberry-leafed non-entity, said the minister, checking himself for a moment in his stride and rolling out his words spasmodically. Who is going to sweep us away, I should like to know. The voting masses are on our side, and all the ability and administrative talent is on our side, too. No power of earth or heaven is going to move us from our place till we choose to quit it. No power of earth or... Belterbay saw, with bulging eyes, a sudden void, where a moment earlier had been a cabinet minister. A void emphasized rather than relieved by the presence of a puffed-out, bewildered-looking sparrow, which hopped about for a moment in a dazed fashion and then fell to a violent cheeping and scolding. If we could understand sparrow language, said the Duke serenely, I fancy we should hear something infinitely worse than strawberry-leafed non-entity. But good heavens, Eugene, said Belterbay hoarsely. What has become of... Why, there he is. How on earth did he get there? And he pointed with a shaking finger towards the semblance of the vanished minister, which approached once more along the unfrequented path. The Duke laughed. It is Quinston, to all outward appearance, he said composedly, but I fancy you will find, on closer investigation, that it is an angel understudy of the real article. The angel Quinston greeted them with a friendly smile. How beastly happy you two look sitting there, he said wistfully. I don't suppose you'd care to change places with poor little us, replied the Duke chaffingly. How about poor little me, said the angel modestly. I've got to run about behind the wheels of popularity like a spotted dog behind a carriage, getting all the dust and trying to look as if I were an important part of the machine. I must seem a perfect fool to you onlookers sometimes. I think you are a perfect angel, said the Duke. The angel that had been Quinston smiled and passed on his way, pursued across the breadth of the Horse Guards parade by a tiresome little sparrow that it cheeped incessantly and furiously at him. That's only the beginning, said the Duke complacently. I've made it operative with all of them, irrespective of parties. Belterbay made no coherent reply. He was engaged in feeling his pulse. The Duke fixed his attention with some interest on a black swan that was swimming with haughty, stiff-necked aloofness amid the crowd of lesser waterfowl that dotted the ornamental water. For all its pride of bearing, something was evidently ruffling and enraging it. In its way, it seemed as angry and amazed as the sparrow had been. At the same moment, a human figure came along the pathway. Belcher Bay looked up apprehensively. "Kedzon," he whispered briefly. "An angel, Kedzon, if I am not mistaken," said the Duke. "Look, he is talking affably to a human being. That settles it." A shabbily dressed lounger had accosted the man who had been a viceroy in the splendid East, and who still reflected in his mien some of the cold dignity of the Himalayan snow peaks. "Could you tell me, sir, if them white birds is storks or albatrosses? I had an argument," the cold dignity thawed at once into genial friendliness. "Those are pelicans, my dear sir. Are you interested in birds? If you would join me in a bun and a glass of milk at a stall yonder, I could tell you some interesting things about Indian birds. Righto. Now, the hill mynah, for instance." The two men disappeared in the direction of the bun stall, chatting volubly as they went, and shadowed from the other side of the railway, the railed enclosure, by a black swan whose temper seemed to have reached the limit of inarticulate rage. Belcher Bay gazed in an open-mouthed wonder after the retreating couple, then transferred his attention to the infuriated swan, and finally turned with a look of scared comprehension at his young friend lolling unconcernedly in his chair. There was no longer any room to doubt what was happening. The silly talk had been translated into a terrifying action. "I think a prairie oyster on top of a stiffish brandy and soda might save my reason," said Belcher Bay weakly as he limped towards his club. It was late in the day before he could steady his nerves sufficiently to glance at the evening papers. The parliamentary report proved significant reading and confirmed fears that he had been trying to shake off. Mr. App Dave, the chancellor, whose lively controversial style endeared him to his supporters and embittered him, politically speaking, to his opponents, had risen in his place to make an unprovoked apology for having alluded in a recent speech to certain protesting taxpayers as skulkers. He had realized on reflection that they were in all probability perfectly honest in their inability to understand certain legal technicalities of the new finance laws. The House had scarcely recovered from this sensation when Lord Hugo Sizzle caused a further flutter of astonishment by going out of his way to indulge in an outspoken appreciation of the fairness, loyalty, and straightforwardness not only of the Chancellor, but of all the members of the Cabinet. A wit had gravely suggested moving the adjournment of the House in view of the unexpected circumstances that had arisen. Belcher Bay anxiously skimmed over a further item of news printed immediately below the parliamentary report. Wildcat found in an exhausted condition in Palace Yard. "Now I wonder which of them," he mused. And then an appalling idea came to him. "Supposing he's put them both into the same beast?" He hurriedly ordered another prairie oyster. Belcher Bay was known in his club as a strictly moderate drinker. His consumption of alcoholic stimulants that day gave rise to considerable comment. The events of the next few days were piquantly bewildering to the world at large. To Belcher Bay, who knew dimly what was happening, the situation was fraught with recurring alarms. The old saying that in politics it's the unexpected that always happens, received a justification that it had hitherto somewhat lacked, and the epidemic of startling personal changes up front was not wholly confined to the realm of actual politics. The eminent chocolate magnat, Sadbury, obviously like Cadbury, but Sadbury, whose antipathy to the turf, that is, horse racing, and everything connected with it, was a matter of general knowledge, had evidently been replaced by an angel Sadbury, who proceeded to electrify the public by blossoming forth as an owner of racehorses, giving as a reason his matured conviction that the sport was, after all, one which gave healthy open-air recreation to large numbers of people drawn from all classes of the community, and incidentally stimulated the important industry of horse breeding. His colors, chocolates, and cream hoops, spangled with pink stars, promised to become as popular as any other on the turf. At the same time, in order to give effect to his condemnation of the evils resulting from the spread of the gambling habit among wage-earning classes, who live for the most part from hand to mouth, he suppressed all betting news and tipsters' forecast in the popular evening paper that was under his control. His action received instant recognition and support from the Angel proprietor of the Evening Views, the principal rival and evening halfpenny paper, who forthwith issued an ukase, it's like a command or a diktat, decreeing a similar ban on betting news, and in a short while the regular evening press was purged of all mention of starting prices and probable winners. A considerable drop in the circulation of all these papers was the immediate result, accompanied, of course, by a falling off in advertisement value, while a crop of special betting broadsheets sprang up to supply the newly created want. Under their influence, the betting habit became, if anything, rather more widely diffused than before. The Duke had possibly overlooked the futility of kepnicking the leaders of the nation, while with excellently intentioned angel understudies, while leaving the mass of the people in its original condition. Further sensation and dislocation was caused in the press world by the sudden and dramatic rapprochement which took place between the angel editor of the Scrutator, I think Spectator, and the angel editor of the Anglian Review, who not only ceased to criticize and disparage the tone and tendencies of each other's publication, but agreed to exchange editorships for alternating periods. Here again, public support was not on the side of the angels. Constant readers of the Scrutator complained bitterly of the strong meat, which was thrust upon them at fitful intervals in place of the almost vegetarian diet to which they had become confidently accustomed. Even those who were not mentally averse to strong meat as a separate course were pardonably annoyed at being supplied with it in the pages of the Scrutator. S-C-R-U-T-A-T-O-R. To be suddenly confronted with a pungent herring salad when one had attuned oneself to tea and toast, or to discover a richly truffled segment of pâté de foie dissembled in a bowl of bread and milk, would be an experience that might upset the equanimity of the most placidly disposed mortal. An equally vehement outcry arose from the regular subscribers of the Anglian Review, as opposed to Anglican Review, who protested against being served from time to time with literary fare which no young person of 16 could possibly want to devour in secret. To take infinite precautions, they complained, against the juvenile perusal of such eminently innocuous, harmless literature was like reading the Riot Act on perusal or on an uninhabited island. So again, people got secret thrills out of reading the Anglican Review in private, certain of its literary reviews, I guess, is what he's saying now. They made it more boring. Both reviews suffered a serious falling off in circulation and influence. Peace hath its devastations as well as war. The wives of noted public men formed another element of discomfiture which the young Duke had almost entirely left out of his calculations. It is sufficiently embarrassing to keep abreast of the possible wobblings and veerings round of a human husband who, from the strength or weakness of his personal character, may leap over or slip through the barriers which divide the parties. For this reason, a merciful politician usually marries late in life when he has definitely made up his mind on which side he wishes his wife to be socially valuable. But these trials were as nothing compared to the bewilderment caused by the angel husbands who seemed in some cases to have revolutionized their outlook on life in the interval between breakfast and dinner, without premonition or preparation of any kind, and apparently without realizing the least need for subsequent explanation. The temporary peace which brooded over the parliamentary situation was by no means reproduced in the home circles of the leading statesmen and politicians. It had been frequently and extensively remarked of Mrs. X, EXE, that she would try the patience of an angel. Now the tables were reversed, and she unwittingly had an opportunity for discovering that the capacity for exasperating behavior was not all on one side. Angel was trying her patience. And then, you see, these are typical ironic reversals we find in all satire, pretty much. And then, with the introduction of the Navy Estimates, parliamentary peace suddenly dissolved. It was the old quarrel between ministers and the opposition as to the adequacy or the reverse of the government naval program. The angel Quinston and the angel Hugo Sizzle contrived to keep the debates free from personalities and pinpricks, but an enormous sensation was created when the elegant, lackadaisical Halfen Halfour threatened to bring up 50,000 stalwarts to wreck the house if the estimates were not forthwith revised on a two-power basis. It was a memorable scene when he rose in his place in response to the scandalized shouts of his opponents and thundered forth, "Gentlemen, I glory in the name of Apache." Belcher Bay, who had made several fruitless attempts to ring up his young friend since the fateful morning in St. James's Park, ran him to earth one afternoon at his club, smooth and spruce and unruffled as ever. Spruce means neat, tidy, kind of cleaned up. Spruce it up, for example. "Tell me, what on earth have you turned Coxley Coxon into?" Belcher Bay asked anxiously, mentioning the name of one of the pillars of orthodoxy, or one of the pillars of unorthodoxy in the Anglican Church. "I don't fancy he believes in angels, and if he finds an angel preaching orthodox sermon from his pulpit while he's been turned into a fox terrier, he'll develop rabies in less than no time." "I rather think it was a fox terrier," said the Duke lazily. Belcher Bay groaned heavily and sank into a chair. "Look here, Eugene," he whispered hoarsely, having first looked well round to see that no one was within hearing range. "You've got to stop it. Consuls are jumping up and down like broncos, and that speech of Halfor's in the House last night has simply startled everybody out of their wits. And then on top of it, Thistlebury..." "What has he been saying?" asked the Duke quickly. "Nothing. That's just what's so disturbing. Everyone thought it was simply inevitable that he should come out with a great epic-making speech at this juncture, and I've just seen on the tape that he has refused to address any meetings at present, giving as reason his opinion that something more than mere speech-making was warranted." The young Duke said nothing, but his eyes shone with quiet exultation. "It's so unlike Thistlebury," continued Belcher Bay. "At least," he said suspiciously, "it's unlike the real Thistlebury." "The real Thistlebury is flying about somewhere as a vocally industrious lapwing," said the Duke calmly. "I expect great things of the angel Thistlebury," he added. At this moment, there was a magnetic stampede of members toward the lobby where the tape machines were ticking out some news of more than ordinary import. "Coup d'etat in the north. Thistlebury seizes Edinburgh Castle. Threatens civil war unless government expands naval program." In the babble which ensued, Belcher Bay lost sight of his young friend. For the best part of the afternoon, he searched one likely haunt after another, spurred on by the sensational posters which the evening papers were displaying broadcast over the West End. "General Baden-Baden mobilizes Boy Scouts." It's the guy who founded the Boy Scouts. Another coup d'etat feared. "Is Windsor Castle safe?" This was one of the earlier posters, and was followed by one of even more sinister purport. "Will the test match have to be postponed?" It was this disquieting question which brought home the real seriousness of the situation to the London public. That's a sporting event, the test match. I think that would be like cricket or something. And made people wonder whether one might not pay too high a price for the advantages of party government. Belcher Bay, questing round in the hope of finding the originator of the trouble, with a vague idea of being able to induce him to restore matters to their normal human footing, came across an elderly club acquaintance who dabbled extensively in some of the more sensitive market securities. He was pale with indignation, and his pallor deepened as a breathless newsboy dashed past with a poster inscribed, "Premier's constituency harried by moss troopers. Halfor sends encouraging telegram to rioters. Letchworth Garden City threatens reprisals. Foreigners taking refuge in embassies and National Liberal Club." "This is the devil's work," he said angrily. Belcher Bay knew otherwise. At the bottom of St. James's Street, a newspaper motor cart, which had just come rapidly along Pall Mall, was surrounded by a knot of eagerly talking people, and for the first time that afternoon, Belcher Bay heard expressions of relief and congratulations. It displayed a placard with the welcome announcement, "Crisis ended. Government gives way. Important expansion of naval program." There seemed to be no immediate necessity for pursuing the quest of the errant Duke, and Belcher Bay turned to make his way homeward through St. James's Park. His mind, attuned to the alarums and excursions of the afternoon, became dimly aware that some excitement of a detached nature was going on around him. In spite of the political ferment which reigned in the streets, quite a large crowd had gathered to watch the unfolding of a tragedy that had taken place on the shore of the ornamental water. A large black swan, which had recently shown signs of a savage and dangerous disposition, had suddenly attacked a young gentleman who was walking by the water's edge, dragged him down under the surface, and drowned him before anyone could come to his assistance. At the moment when Belcher Bay arrived on the spot, several park keepers were engaged in lifting the corpse into a punt. That's a little boat. Belcher Bay stooped to pick up a hat that lay near the scene of the struggle. It was a smart, soft felt hat, faintly reminiscent of a Hoobegon. More than a month elapsed before Belcher Bay had sufficiently recovered from his attack of nervous prostration to take an interest once more in what was going on in the world of politics. The parliamentary session was still in full swing, and a general election was looming in the near future. He called for a batch of morning papers and skimmed rapidly through the speeches of the Chancellor, Quinston, and other ministerial leaders, as well as those of the principal opposition champions, and then sank back in his chair with a sigh of relief. Evidently, the spell had ceased to act after the tragedy, which had overtaken its invoker. There was no trace of Angel anywhere. So that was Ministers of Grace. And now the last story of the Clovis section. The remolding of Groby, G-R-O-B-Y, Lington, L-I-N-G-T-O-N. The remolding of Groby Lington. Citing the precept, a man is known by the adage, a man is known by the company he keeps. The remolding of Groby Lington. In the morning room of his sister-in-law's house, Groby Lington fidgeted away the passing minutes with the demure restlessness of advanced middle age. About a quarter of an hour he would have to elapse before it would be time to say his goodbyes and make his way across the village green to the station with a selected escort of nephews and nieces. He was a good-natured, kindly dispositioned man, and in theory he was delighted to pay periodical visits to the wife and children of his dead brother William. In practice, he infinitely preferred the comfort and seclusion of his own house and garden and the companionship of his books and his parrot to these rather meaningless and tiresome incursions into a family circle with which he had little in common. It was not so much the spur of his own conscience that drove him to make the occasional short journey by rail to visit his relatives, as an obedient concession to the more insistent but vicarious conscience of his brother, Colonel John, who was apt to accuse him of neglecting poor old William's family. Groby usually forgot or ignored the existence of his neighbor kinfolk until such time as he was threatened with a visit from the colonel, when he would put matters straight by a hurried pilgrimage across the few miles of intervening country to renew his acquaintance with the young people and assume a kindly, if rather forced, interest in the well-being of his sister-in-law. On this occasion, he had cut matters so fine between the timing of his exculpatory visit and the coming of Colonel John that he would scarcely be home before the latter was due to arrive. Anyhow, Groby had got it over, and 6 or 7 months might decently elapse before he need again sacrifice his comforts and inclinations on the altar of family sociability. What was that line in the movie? You know the English, they hate people and they love dogs. He was inclined to be distinctly cheerful as he hopped about the room, picking up first one object, then another, and subjecting each to a brief bird-like scrutiny. Presently, his cheerful listlessness changed sharply to an attitude of vexed attention. In a scrapbook of drawings and caricatures belonging to one of his nephews, he had come across an unkindly clever sketch of himself and his parrot, solemnly confronting each other in postures of ridiculous gravity and repose, and bearing a likeness to one another that the artist had done by his utmost to accentuate. So one of his nephews or nieces drew a picture of him looking like his parrot. After the first flush of annoyance had passed away, Groby laughed good-naturedly and admitted to himself the cleverness of the drawing. Then the feeling of resentment repossessed him, resentment not against the caricaturist who had embodied the idea in pen and ink, but against the possible truth that the idea represented. Was it really the case that people grew in time to resemble the animals they kept as pets? And had he unconsciously become more and more like the comically solemn bird that was his constant companion? Groby was unusually silent as he walked to the train with his escort of chattering nephews and nieces, and during the short railway journey his mind was more and more possessed with an introspective conviction that he had gradually settled down into a sort of parrot-like existence. What, after all, did his daily routine amount to but a sedate meandering and pecking and perching in his garden, among his fruit trees, in his wicker chair on the lawn, or by the fireside in his library? And what was the sum total of his conversation with chance-encountered neighbors? "Quite a spring day, isn't it? It looks as though we should have some rain. Glad to see you about again. You must take care of yourself. How the young folks shoot up, don't they?" Strings of stupid, inevitable, perfunctory remarks came to his mind, remarks that were certainly not the mental exchange of human intelligences, but mere empty parrot talk. One might really just as well salute one's acquaintances with, "Pretty Polly, puss puss, meow." Groby began to fume against the picture of himself as a foolish feathered fowl, which his nephew's sketch had first suggested, and which his own accusing imagination was filling in with such unflattering detail. "I'll give the beastly bird away," he said resentfully, though he knew at the same time he would do no such thing. It would look so absurd after all the years that he had kept the parrot and made much of it, suddenly to try and find it a new home. "Has my brother arrived?" he asked of the stable boy who had come with the pony carriage to meet him. "Yes, sir, he came in the 2:15. Your parrot's dead." The boy made the latter announcement with the relish which his class finds in proclaiming a catastrophe. "My parrot dead?" said Groby. "What caused its death?" "The ipe," said the boy briefly. "The ipe?" queried Groby. "Whatever's that?" "The ipe, what the colonel brought with him," came the rather alarming answer. "Do you mean to say my brother is ill? Is it something infectious?" "The colonel's so well as he ever was," said the boy. "The colonel's so well as ever he was," said the boy, and as no further explanation was forthcoming, Groby had to possess himself in mystified patience till he reached home. His brother was waiting for him at the hall door. "Have you heard about the parrot?" he asked at once. "Upon my soul, I'm awfully sorry. The moment he saw the monkey I'd brought down as a surprise for you, he squawked out, 'Rats to you, sir!' And the blessed monkey made one spring at him and got him by the neck and whirled him around like a rattle. He was as dead as mutton by the time I'd got him out of the little beggar's paws. Always been such a friendly little beast, the monkey has, and should never have thought that he'd got it in him to see red like that. Can't tell you how sorry I feel about it. And now, of course, you'll hate the sight of the monkey." "Not at all," said Groby sincerely. A few hours earlier, the tragic end which had befallen his parrot would have presented itself to him as a calamity. Now it arrived almost as a polite attention on the part of the fates. So he's thinking it's a sign. These two things, the caricature and the death of the parrot, are a sign that he needs to alter his life and, I guess, get a little more energetic. "The bird was getting old, you know," he went on, and in explanation of his obvious lack of decent regret at the loss of his pet, "I was really beginning to wonder if it was an unmixed kindness to let him go on living till he succumbed to old age. What a charming little monkey," he added, when it was introduced to the culprit. The newcomer was a small, long-tailed monkey from the Western Hemisphere, with a gentle, half-shy, half-trusting manner that instantly captured Groby's confidence. A student of simian character might have seen in the fitful red light in its eyes some indication of the underlying temper which the parrot had so rashly put to the test with such dramatic consequences for itself. The servants, who had come to regard the defunct bird as a regular member of the household, and one who gave really very little trouble, were scandalized to find his bloodthirsty aggressor installed in his place as an honored domestic pet. "A nasty heathen ipe, what don't never say nothing sensible and cheerful, same as poor Polly did," was the unfavorable version of the kitchen quarters. And the first time I saw it, it spelled I-P-E. I didn't realize he was saying ape. "Nasty even ipe it is. Nice Polly with her nice words replaced by this nasty little murderous heathen," is what was the unfavorable verdict of the kitchen quarters. So very, very, very pronounced class difference in England. In America, a new continent, lots of room, few people, what you could do was all that really counted. In England, a long-established country of not very much land, full of people, it's settled, and who you know and what money you have are more important. Much less movement between classes, much less room for talent. That's why so many people came to the New World. Not just from England, that's the story for everywhere. Europe itself is not very big. One Sunday morning, some 12 or 14 months after the visit of Colonel John and the parrot tragedy, Miss Wepley sat decorously in her pew in the parish church, immediately in front of that occupied by Groby Linton. She was, comparatively speaking, a newcomer in the neighborhood and was not personally acquainted with her fellow worshiper in the seat behind, but for the past 2 years the Sunday morning service had brought them regularly within each other's sphere of consciousness. Without having paid particular attention to the subject, she could probably have given a correct rendering of the way in which he pronounced certain words occurring in the responses to the preacher, while he was well aware of the trivial fact that, in addition to her prayer book and handkerchief, a small paper packet of throat lozenges always reposed on the seat beside her. Miss Wepley rarely had recourse to the lozenges, but in case she should be taken with a fit of coughing, she wished to have the emergency duly provided for, so we're seeing her actions and behavior show her character. Preparation is a sign of it's largely what separates ability to see ahead, which is reflected in preparation, is largely what separates, and ultimately it's born of IQ more than anything, separates the materially better off, the more provident, from the people who call apes ipes. So you can tell that she might be a fit companion and bring a little more liveliness merely by virtue of her imagination into the life of Groby Linton, if she herself would care to associate with such a person. That's a wild guess. I'm also guessing he might have brought the monkey to church and she might grab her hat or something. But then again, upon reflection, I don't think you'd really bring a monkey to church. You would have to be a true African to be legal inside the doors, I would think, at that time. Probably today you probably could, but no one would think anything of it. Probably get it baptized. We made a nice donation, scheduled the time. Anyway, so this woman is sitting there in church in her usual spot, but they're within each other's sphere of consciousness, which is how many things begin on proximity. Now, she wished to have the emergency duly provided for. On this particular Sunday, the lozenges occasioned an unusual diversion in the even tenor of her devotions, far more disturbing to her personally than a prolonged attack of coughing would have been. As she rose to take part in the singing of the first hymn, she fancied that she saw the hand of her neighbor, who was alone in the pew behind her, make a furtive downward grab at the packet lying on the seat. On turning round, she found that the packet had certainly disappeared, but Mr. Linton was to all outward passages serenely intent on his hymn book. No amount of interrogatory glaring on the part of the despoiled lady could bring the least shade of conscious guilt to his face. Okay, so remember what the adage at the start, a man is known by the company he keeps. So instead of being a dull, stolid parrot, he's now turning into a thieving little monkey. This is kind of delightful to me, anyway. Worse was to follow, as she remarked afterwards to a scandalized audience of friends and acquaintances. So I guessed wrong, you see what's going on. I had scarcely knelt in prayer when a lozenge, one of my lozenges, came whizzing into the pew just under my nose. I turned round and stared, but Mr. Linton had his eyes closed and his lips moving as though engaged in prayer. The moment I resumed my devotions, another lozenge came rattling in, and then another. I took no notice for a while, and then turned round suddenly, just as the dreadful man was about to flip another one at me. He hastily pretended to be turning over the leaves of his book, but I was not to be taken in that time. He saw that he had been discovered, and no more lozenges came. Of course, I have changed my pew. No gentleman would have acted in such a disgraceful manner, said one of her listeners, and yet Mr. Linton used to be so respected by everybody. He seems to have behaved like a little ill-bred schoolboy. He behaved like a monkey, said Miss Wepley. Her unfortunate verdict was echoed in other quarters about the same time. Groby Linton had never been a hero in the eyes of his personal retainers, but he had shared the approval accorded to his defunct parrot as a cheerful, well-dispositioned body who gave no particular trouble. Of late months, however, this character would hardly have been endorsed by the members of his domestic establishment. The solid stable boy, who had first announced to him the tragic end of his feathered pet, was one of the first to give voice to the murmurs of disapproval, which became rampant and general in the servants' quarters, and he had fairly substantial grounds for his disaffection. In a burst of hot summer weather, he had obtained permission to bathe in a modest-sized pond in the orchard, and thither, one afternoon, Groby had bent his steps, attracted by loud imprecations of anger, mingled with a shriller chattering of monkey language. He beheld his plump, diminutive servitor, clad only in a waistcoat and a pair of socks, storming ineffectually at the monkey, which was seated on a low branch of an apple tree, abstractedly fingering the remainder of the boy's outfit, which he had removed just out of his reach. "The ape's been and took me clothes," whined the boy, with the passion of his kind for explaining the obvious. See, there's a good class tell right there. See, English, we got to be subtle, and we must never speak that direct. Now, I personally don't agree with this, but they're saying that it's a mark of the upper class not to speak the obvious, to say only the direct, to understate. These are always traditional English things. To assume that you have eyes and can see the obvious, but this leads into traps, as we see politically. But we're doing literature right now. We don't go too far into them, but this is how a culture is created. And this, in the midst of a story, this is why you read literature. One reason you read it, not just for entertainment, but for, you get better psychology than you get in psychology itself. So the direct statement of something is seen as a low-class thing that servants do. Isn't that something? What a way of conceiving the world. "The ape's been and took me clothes," whined the boy, with the passion of his kind for explaining the obvious. His incomplete toilet effect rather embarrassed him, but he hailed the arrival of Groby with relief as promising moral and material support in his efforts to get back his raided garments. The monkey had ceased its defiant jabbering, and doubtless with a little coaxing from its master, it would hand back the plunder. "If I lift you up," suggested Groby, "you will just be able to reach the clothes." The boy agreed, and Groby clutched him firmly by the waistcoat, which was about all there was to catch hold of, and lifted him clear of the ground. Then, with a deft swing, he sent him crashing into a clump of tall nettles, which closed receptively around him. Nettles are stinging, pricking plants. It would be very painful. The victim had not been brought up in a school which teaches one to repress one's emotions. So again, emotional repression is high class. Emotional volatility or emotional expression is low class in England. If a fox had attempted to gnaw at his vitals, he would have flown to complain to the nearest hunt committee rather than have affected an attitude of stoical indifference. On this occasion, the volume of sound which he produced under the stimulus of pain and rage and astonishment was generous and sustained. But above his bellowings, he could distinctly hear the triumphant chattering of his enemy in the tree, and a peal of shrill laughter from Groby. So Groby and the monkey are now forming a team. When the boy had finished an improvised St. Vitus caracole, which I think is a dance, which would have brought him fame on the boards of the Colosseum. St. Vitus' dance. I think there was a dance from a disease, and his disease is he's just been pricked by millions of nettles. It's like falling off, being thrown into a cactus or something. And which indeed met with ready appreciation and applause from the retreating figure of Groby Lington, he found that the monkey had also discreetly retired, while his clothes were scattered on the grass at the foot of the tree. "They'm two ipes, that's what they be," he muttered angrily, as if his judgment was severe. At least he spoke under the sting of considerable provocation. It was a week or two later that the parlor maid gave notice, having been terrified almost to tears by an outbreak of sudden temper on the part of the master anent some underdone cutlets. "He gnashed his teeth at me, he did really," she informed. A sympathetic kitchen audience. "Gnashed his teeth, or you know how monkeys do. I'd like to see him talk to me like that now, I would," said the cook defiantly, but her cooking from that moment showed a marked improvement. It was seldom that Groby Lington so far detached himself from his accustomed habits as to go and form one of a house party, and he was not a little piqued that Mrs. Glenduff should have stowed him away in the musty old Georgian wing of the house in the next room, moreover, to Leonard Spabink, the eminent pianist. "He plays Liszt like an angel," had been the hostess's enthusiastic testimonial. "He may play him like a trout, for all I care," had been Groby's mental comment, "but I wouldn't mind betting that he snores. He's just the sort and shape that would. And if I hear him snoring through those ridiculous thin-paneled walls, there'll be trouble." He did, and there was. Groby stood it for about 2.25 minutes and then made his way through the corridor into Spobink's room. Under Groby's vigorous measures, the musician's flabby, redundant figure sat up in a bewildered semi-consciousness like an ice cream that has been taught to beg. Groby prodded him into complete wakefulness, and then the pettish, self-satisfied pianist fairly lost his temper and slapped his domineering visitant on the hand. In another moment, Spabink was being nearly stifled and very effectually gagged by a pillowcase tightly bound round his head, while his plump, pajamaed limbs were hauled out of bed and smacked, pinched, kicked, and bumped in a catch-as-catch-can progress across the floor towards the flat, shallow bath in whose utterly inadequate depths Groby perseveringly strove to drown him. For a few moments, the room was almost in darkness. Groby's candle had overturned in an early stage of the scuffle, and its flicker scarcely reached to the spot where the splashings, smacks, muffled cries, and splutterings, and a chatter of ape-like rage told of the struggle that was being waged round the shores of the bath. A few instants later, the one-sided combat was brightly lit up by the flare of blazing curtains and rapidly kindling paneling. When the hastily aroused members of the house party stampeded out onto the lawn, the Georgian wing was well alight and belching forth masses of smoke, but some moments elapsed before Groby appeared with the half-drowned pianist in his arms, having just bethought him of the superior drowning facilities offered by the pond at the bottom of the lawn. The cool night air sobered his rage, and when he found that he was innocently acclaimed as the heroic rescuer of poor Leonard Spabink, and loudly commended for his presence of mind in tying a wet cloth round his head to protect him from smoke suffocation, he accepted the situation and subsequently gave a graphic account of his finding the musician asleep with an overturned candle by his side and the conflagration well started. Spabink gave his version some days later when he had partially recovered from the shock of his midnight castigation and immersion, but gentle pitying smiles and evasive comments with which his story was greeted warned him that the public ear was not at his disposal. He refused, however, to attend the ceremonial presentation of the Royal Humane Society's life-saving medal. It was about this time that Groby's pet monkey fell victim to the disease which attacks so many of its kind when brought under the influence of a northern climate. Its master appeared to be profoundly affected by its loss and never quite recovered the level of spirits that he had recently attained. In company with the tortoise, which Colonel John presented to him on his last visit, he potters about on his lawn and kitchen garden with none of his erstwhile sprightliness, and his nephews and nieces are fairly well justified in alluding to him as Old Uncle Groby. So he was like his parrot, he became like his monkey, and then he went back when his monkey ended. So the people you hang around with, the fool you flatter is the fool you become, the pet you care for is the pet you imitate. You start to look like your wife, you start to look like and think like and talk like and act like those you hang around. Pretty much true, and that doesn't stop at the human border. In any case, that ends the Clovis section of the Complete Stories of Saki, but we are only about not quite one-third of the way into them, so there are a lot more to come. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I'm Alex Linder, and as I've said, you can find everything we record at vnnforum.com. Go to our The Massive for all of the audiobook material. All of the audio material we have will eventually one day there be listed in better order than it is now, but I dare say there's thousands of hours of material there right now, whether it's part of the Learning College formally or not. It's all for your benefit. And you can spread it to anyone you like. So thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for more from Saki real soon.